This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents Fifth Business, Book 1 of the Deptford Trilogy, written by Robertson Davies. Narrated by Mark Vitor.
Fifth Business, Definition. Those roles which, being neither those of hero nor heroine, confidant nor villain, but which were nonetheless essential to bring about the recognition or the denouement, were called the fifth business in drama and opera companies organized according to the old style. The player who acted these parts was often referred to as fifth business. Thomas Overskue, Den Danske Skøplats. Chapter 1. Mrs. Dempster. 1. My lifelong involvement with Mrs. Dempster began at 5:58 o'clock p.m. on 27 December 1908, at which time I was 10 years and 7 months old. I am able to date the occasion with complete certainty because that afternoon I had been sledding with my lifelong friend and enemy, Percy Boyd Staunton, and we had quarreled because his fine new Christmas sled would not go as fast as my old one. Snow was never heavy in our part of the world, but this Christmas it had been plentiful enough almost to cover the tallest spears of dried grass in the fields. In such snow, his sled, with its tall runners and foolish steering apparatus, was clumsy and apt to stick, whereas my low-slung old affair would almost have slid on grass without snow. The afternoon had been humiliating for him, and when Percy was humiliated, he was vindictive. His parents were rich. His clothes were fine, and his mittens were of skin and came from a store in the city, whereas mine were knitted by my mother. It was manifestly wrong, therefore, that his splendid sled should not go faster than mine, and when such injustice showed itself, Percy became cranky. He slighted my sled, scoffed at my mittens, and at last came right out and said that his father was better than my father. Instead of hitting him, which might have started a fight that could have ended in a draw or even a defeat for me, I said, "All right, then, I would go home, and he could have the field to himself." This was crafty of me, for I knew it was getting on for supper time, and one of our home rules was that nobody, under any circumstances, was to be late for a meal. So I was keeping the home rule while at the same time leaving Percy to himself. As I walked back to the village, he followed me, shouting fresh insults. "When I walked," he taunted, "I staggered like an old cow. My woolen cap was absurd beyond all belief. My backside was immense and wobbled when I walked, and more of the same sort, for his invention was not lively." I said nothing, because I knew that this spited him more than any retort, and that every time he shouted at me, he lost face. Our village was so small that you came on it at once. It lacked the dignity of outskirts. I darted up our street, putting on speed, for I had looked ostentatiously at my new Christmas dollar watch. Percy had a watch, but was not let wear it because it was too good, and saw that it was 5:57, just time to get indoors, wash my hands in the noisy, splashy way my parents seemed to like, and be in my place at 6, my head bent for grace. Percy was by this time hopping mad, and I knew I had spoiled his supper and probably his whole evening. Then the unforeseen took over. Walking up the street ahead of me were the Reverend Amasa Dempster and his wife. He had her arm tucked in his and was leaning towards her in the protective way he had. I was familiar with this sight, for they always took a walk at this time, after dark and when most people were at supper, because Mrs. Dempster was going to have a baby, and it was not the custom in our village for pregnant women to show themselves boldly in the streets, not if they had any position to keep up, and of course the Baptist minister's wife had a position. Percy had been throwing snowballs at me from time to time, and I had ducked them all. I had a boy's sense of when a snowball was coming, and I knew Percy. I was sure that he would try to land one last insulting snowball between my shoulders before I ducked into our house. I stepped briskly, not running, but not dawdling, in front of the Dempsters, just as Percy threw, and the snowball hit Mrs. Dempster on the back of the head. She gave a cry, and, clinging to her husband, slipped to the ground. He might have caught her if he had not turned at once to see who had thrown the snowball. I had meant to dart into our house, but I was unnerved by hearing Mrs. Dempster. I had never heard an adult cry in pain before, and the sound was terrible to me. Falling, she burst into nervous tears, and suddenly there she was, on the ground, with her husband kneeling beside her, holding her in his arms and speaking to her in terms of endearment that were strange and embarrassing to me. I had never heard married people, or any people, speak unashamedly loving words before. I knew that I was watching a scene, and my parents had always warned against scenes as very serious breaches of propriety. I stood gaping, and then Mr. Dempster became conscious of me. "Danny," he said, I did not know he knew my name, "lend us your sleigh to get my wife home." I was contrite and guilty, for I knew that the snowball had been meant for me, but the Dempsters did not seem to think of that. He lifted his wife on my sled, which was not hard because she was a small, girlish woman, and as I pulled it towards their house, he walked beside it, very awkwardly bent over her, supporting her and uttering soft endearment and encouragement, for she went on crying like a child. Their house was not far away, just around the corner, really, but by the time I had been there and seen Mr. Dempster take his wife inside and found myself unwanted outside, it was a few minutes after 6, and I was late for supper. But I pelted home, pausing only for a moment at the scene of the accident, washed my hands, slipped into my place at table, and made my excuse, looking straight into my mother's sternly interrogative eyes. I gave my story a slightly historical bias, leaning firmly but not absurdly on my own role as the Good Samaritan. I suppressed any information or guesswork about where the snowball had come from, and to my relief my mother did not pursue that aspect of it. She was much more interested in Mrs. Dempster, and when supper was over and the dishes washed, she told my father she thought she would just step over to the Dempsters and see if there was anything she could do. On the face of it, this was a curious decision of my mother's, for, of course, we were Presbyterians, and Mrs. Dempster was the wife of the Baptist parson. Not that there was any ill will among the denominations in our village, but it was understood that each looked after its own, unless a situation got too big, when outside help might be called in. But my mother was, in a modest way, a specialist in matters relating to pregnancy and childbirth. Dr. McCausland had once paid her the great compliment of saying that Mrs. Ramsay had her head screwed on straight. She was ready to put this levelness of head at the service of almost anybody who needed it. And she had a tenderness, never obviously displayed, for poor, silly Mrs. Dempster, who was not 21 yet and utterly unfit to be a preacher's wife. So off she went, and I read my Christmas annual of the boy's own paper, and my father read something that looked hard and had small print, and my older brother Willie read The Cruise of the Cachalot, all of us sitting round the base burner with our feet on the nickel guard till 8:30. And then we boys were sent to bed. I have never been quick to go to sleep, and I lay awake until the clock downstairs struck 9:30, and shortly after that I heard my mother return. There was a stovepipe in our house that came from the general living room into the upstairs hall, and it was a fine conductor of sound. I crept out into the hall. Willie slept like a bear. Put my ear as near to it as the heat permitted, and heard my mother say, "I've just come back for a few things. I'll probably be all night. Get me all the baby blankets out of the trunk, and then go right down to Ruckles and make him get you a big roll of cotton wool from the store, the finest he has, and bring it to the Dempsters. The doctor says if it isn't a big roll, to get two."
"You don't mean it's coming now?"
"Yes, away early. Don't wait up for me."
But of course he did wait up for her, and it was 4 a.m. when she came home, self-possessed and grim, as I could tell from her voice as I heard them talking before she returned to the Dempsters. Why, I did not know. And I lay awake, too, feeling guilty and strange. That was how Paul Dempster, whose reputation is doubtless familiar to you, though that was not the name under which he gained it, came to be born early on the morning of 28 December in 1908. 2. In making this report to you, my dear headmaster, I have purposely begun with the birth of Paul Dempster, because this is the cause of so much that is to follow. But why, you will ask, am I writing to you at all? Why, after a professional association of so many years, during which I have been reticent about my personal affairs, am I impelled now to offer you such a statement as this? It is because I was deeply offended by the idiotic piece that appeared in the College Chronicle in the issue of Midsummer 1969. It is not merely its illiteracy of tone that disgusts me, though I think the quarterly publication of a famous Canadian school ought to do better, but its presentation to the public of a portrait of myself as a typical old schoolmaster doddering into retirement with tears in his eyes and a drop hanging from his nose. But it speaks for itself, and here it is, in all its inanity. Farewell to the Cork. A feature of Breakup last June was the dinner given in honor of Dunstan Corky Ramsey, who was retiring after 45 years at the school, and assistant head and senior history master for the last 22. More than 168 old boys, including several MPs and 2 cabinet ministers, were present, and our able dietitian, Mrs. Pierce, surpassed herself in providing a truly fine spread for the occasion. Corky himself was in fine form, despite his years and the coronary that laid him up following the death of his lifelong friend, the late Boy Staunton, D.S.O., C.B.E., known to us all as an old boy and chairman of the Board of Governors of this school. He spoke of his long years as a teacher and friend to innumerable boys, many of whom now occupy positions of influence and prominence, in firm tones that many a younger man might envy. Corky's career may serve both as an example and a warning to young masters, for, as he said, he came to the school in 1924, intending to stay only a few years, and now he has completed his 45th. During that time, he has taught history, as he sees it, to countless boys, many of whom have gone on to a more scientific study of the subject in the universities of Canada, the U.S., and the U.K. 4 heads of history departments in Canadian universities, former pupils of Corky's, were head-table guests at the dinner, and one of them, Dr. E.S. Warren of the University of Toronto, paid a generous, non-critical tribute to the Cork, praising his unfailing enthusiasm and referring humorously to his explanations of the borderland between history and myth. This last subject was again slyly hinted at in the gift presented to Corky at the close of the evening, which was a fine tape recorder, by means of which it is hoped he may make available some of his reminiscences of an earlier and undoubtedly less complicated era of the school's history. Tapes recording the headmaster's fine tribute to Corky were included, and also one of the school choir singing what must be the Cork's favorite hymn, never more appropriate than on this occasion, "For all the saints who from their labors rest." And so the school says, "Goodbye and good luck, Corky. You served the school well, according to your lights in your day and generation. Well done, thou good and faithful servant." There you have it, headmaster, as it came from the pen of that ineffable jackass, Lorne Packer, M.A., and aspirant to a Ph.D. Need I anatomize my indignation? Does it not reduce me to what Packer unquestionably believes me to be, a senile former worthy who has stumbled through 45 years of teaching, armed only with a shallow boys' book of battles concept of history and a bee in his bonnet about myth, whatever the dullard Packer imagines myth to be? I do not complain that no reference was made to my V.C. Enough was said about that at the school in the days when such decorations were thought to add to the prestige of a teacher. However, I think something might have been said about my 10 books, of which at least one has circulated in 6 languages and has sold over 750,000 copies, and another exerts a widening influence in the realm of mythic history, about which Packer attempts to be jocose. The fact that I am the only Protestant contributor to Analecta Bollandiana, and have been so for 36 years, is ignored, though Hippolyte Delahaye himself thought well of my work and said so in print. But what most galls me is the patronizing, dismissive tone of the piece, as if I had never had a life outside the classroom, had never risen to the full stature of a man, had never rejoiced or sorrowed or known love or hate, had never, in short, been anything except what lies within the comprehension of the donkey Packer, who has known me slightly for 4 years. Packer, who pushes me towards oblivion with tags of biblical quotation, the gross impertinence of which he is unable to appreciate, religious illiterate that he is. Packer and his scientific view of history. Oh, God. Packer, who cannot know and could not conceive that I have been cast by fate and my own character for the vital, though never glorious, role of fifth business. Who could not, indeed, comprehend what fifth business is, even if he should meet the player of that part in his own trivial life drama. So, as I feel my strength returning in this house among the mountains, a house that itself holds the truths behind many illusions, I am driven to explain myself to you, Headmaster, because you stand at the top of that queer school world in which I seem to have cut such a meager figure. But what a job it is! Look at what I wrote at the beginning of this memoir. Have I caught anything at all of that extraordinary night when Paul Dempster was born? I'm pretty sure that my little sketch of Percy Boyd Staunton is accurate, but what about myself? I have always sneered at autobiographies and memoirs in which the writer appears at the beginning as a charming, knowing little fellow, possessed of insights and perceptions beyond his years, yet offering these with a false naivete to the reader, as though to say, "What a little wonder I was, but all boy." Have the writers any notion or true recollection of what a boy is? I have, and I have reinforced it by 45 years of teaching boys. A boy is a man in miniature, and though he may sometimes exhibit notable virtue, as well as characteristics that seem to be charming because they are childlike, he is also schemer, self-seeker, traitor, Judas, crook, and villain. In short, a man. Oh, these autobiographies in which the writer postures and simpers as a David Copperfield or a Huck Finn. False. False as harlot's oaths. Can I write truly of my boyhood? Or will that disgusting self-love which so often attaches itself to a man's idea of his youth creep in and falsify the story? I can but try. And to begin, I must give you some notion of the village in which Percy Boyd Staunton and Paul Dempster and I were born. 3. Village life has been so extensively explored by movies and television during recent years that you may shrink from hearing more about it. I shall be as brief as I can, for it is not by piling up detail that I hope to achieve my picture, but by putting the emphasis where I think it belongs. Once it was the fashion to represent villages as places inhabited by laughable, lovable simpletons, unspotted by the worldliness of city life, though occasionally shrewd in rural concerns. Later, it was the popular thing to show villages as rotten with vice, and especially such sexual vice as Kraft Ebbing might have been surprised to uncover in Vienna. Incest, sodomy, bestiality, sadism, and masochism were supposed to rage behind the lace curtains and in the haylofts, while a rigid piety was professed in the streets. Our village never seemed to me to be like that. It was more varied in what it offered to the observer than people from bigger and more sophisticated places generally think. And if it had sins and follies and roughnesses, it also had much to show of virtue, dignity, and even of nobility. It was called Deptford, and lay on the Thames River about 15 miles east of Pittstown, our county town and nearest big place. We had an official population of about 500, and the surrounding farms probably brought the district up to 800 souls. We had 5 churches, the Anglican, poor but believed to have some mysterious social supremacy, the Presbyterian, solvent and thought chiefly by itself to be intellectual, the Methodist, insolvent and fervent, the Baptist, insolvent and saved, the Roman Catholic, mysterious to most of us but clearly solvent, as it was frequently and, so we thought, quite needlessly repainted. We supported 1 lawyer, who was also the magistrate, and 1 banker in a private bank, as such things still existed at that time. We had 2 doctors, Dr. McCausland, who was reputed to be clever, and Dr. Staunton, who was Percy's father, and who was also clever, but in the realm of real estate. He was a great holder of mortgages and owned several farms. We had a dentist, a wretch without manual skill, whose wife underfed him, and who had positively the dirtiest professional premises I have ever seen, and a veterinarian who drank but could rise to an occasion. We had a canning factory which operated noisily and feverishly when there was anything to can, also a sawmill and a few shops. The village was dominated by a family called Athelstan, who had done well out of lumber early in the 19th century. They owned Deptford's only three-story house, which stood by itself on the way to the cemetery. Most of our houses were of wood, and some of them stood on piles, for the Thames had a trick of flooding. One of the remaining Athelstans lived across the street from us, a poor, demented old woman who used from time to time to escape from her nurse housekeeper and rush into the road, where she threw herself down, raising a cloud of dust like a hen having a dirt bath, shouting loudly, "Christian men, come and help me!" It usually took the housekeeper and at least one other person to pacify her. My mother often assisted in this way, but I could not do so, for the old lady disliked me. I seemed to remind her of some false friend in the past. But I was interested in her madness and longed to talk with her, so I always rushed to the rescue when she made one of her breaks for liberty. My family enjoyed a position of modest privilege, for my father was the owner and editor of the local weekly paper, the Deptford Banner. It was not a very prosperous enterprise, but with the job printing plant it sustained us, and we never wanted for anything. My father, as I learned later, never did a gross business of $5,000 in any year that he owned it. He was not only publisher and editor, but chief mechanic and printer as well, helped by a melancholy youth called Jumper Saul and a girl called Nell Bullock. It was a good little paper, respected and hated as a proper local paper should be. The editorial comment, which my father composed directly on the typesetting machine, was read carefully every week. So we were, in a sense, the literary leaders of the community, and my father had a seat on the library board along with the magistrate. Our household, then, was representative of the better sort of life in the village, and we thought well of ourselves. Some of this good opinion arose from being Scots. My father had come from Dumfries as a young man, but my mother's family had been three generations in Canada without having become a whit less Scots than when her grandparents left Inverness. The Scots, I believed until I was aged at least 25, were the salt of the earth, for although this was never said in our household, it was one of those accepted truths which do not need to be labored. By far the majority of the Deptford people had come to Western Ontario from the south of England, so we were not surprised that they looked to us, the Ramsays, for common sense, prudence, and right opinions on virtually everything. Cleanliness, for example. My mother was clean. Oh, but she was clean. Our privy set the sanitary tone of the village. We depended on wells in Deptford, and water for all purposes was heated in a tank called a cistern on the side of the kitchen range. Every house had a privy, and these ranked from dilapidated, noisome shacks to some quite smart edifices, of which our own was clearly among the best. There has been much hilarity about privies in the years since they became rarities, but they were not funny buildings, and if they were not to become disgraceful, they needed a lot of care. As well as this temple of hygiene, we had a chemical closet in the house for use when someone was unwell. It was so capricious and smelly, however, that it merely added a new misery to illness and was rarely set going. That is all that seems necessary to say about Deptford at present. Any necessary additional matter will present itself as part of my narrative. We were serious people, missing nothing in our community and feeling ourselves in no way inferior to larger places. We did, however, look with pitying amusement on Bowles Corners, 4 miles distant and with a population of 150. To live in Bowles Corners, we felt, was to be rustic beyond redemption. 4. The first 6 months of Paul Dempster's life were perhaps the most exciting and pleasurable period of my mother's life, and unquestionably the most miserable of mine. Premature babies had a much poorer chance of surviving in 1908 than they have now. But Paul was the first challenge of this sort in my mother's experience of childbirth, and she met it with all her determination and ingenuity. She was not, I must make clear, in any sense a midwife or a trained person. Simply a woman of good sense and kindness of heart who enjoyed the authority of nursing, and the mystery which at that time still hung about the peculiarly feminine functions. She spent a great part of each day, and not a few nights, at the Dempsters during that 6 months. Other women helped when they could, but my mother was the acknowledged high priestess, and Dr. McCausland was good enough to say that without her he could never have pulled little Paul safely up onto the shores of this world. I learned all the gynecological and obstetrical details as they were imparted piecemeal to my father. The difference was that he sat comfortably beside the living-room stove opposite my mother, while I stood barefoot and in my nightshirt beside the stovepipe upstairs, guilt-ridden and sometimes nauseated as I heard things that were new and terrible to my ears. Paul was premature by some 80 days, as well as Dr. McCausland could determine. The shock of being struck by the snowball had brought Mrs. Dempster to a series of hysterical crying fits, with which her husband was clumsily trying to cope when my mother arrived on the scene. Not long afterward it had become clear that she was about to bear her child, and Dr. McCausland was sent for. But as he was elsewhere making a call, he did not arrive until a quarter of an hour before the birth. Because the child was so small, it came quickly, as the time for first children goes, and looked so wretched that the doctor and my mother were frightened, though they did not admit it to one another until some weeks afterward. It was characteristic of the time and the place that nobody thought to weigh the child, though the Reverend Amasa Dempster christened it immediately, after a brief wrangle with Dr. McCausland. This was by no means in accord with the belief of his faith, but he was not himself and may have been acting in response to promptings stronger than seminary training. My mother said Dempster wanted to dip the child in water, but Dr. McCausland brusquely forbade it, and the distracted father had to be content with sprinkling. During the ceremony, my mother held the child, now named Paul, as it was the first name that came into Dempster's head, as near the stove as she could, in the hottest towels she could provide. But Paul must have weighed something in the neighborhood of 3 pounds, for that was what he still weighed 10 weeks later, having gained little, so far as the eye could judge, in all that time. My mother was not one to dwell on unsightly or macabre things, but she spoke of Paul's ugliness to my father with what was almost fascination. He was red, of course, all babies are red. But he was wrinkled like a tiny old man, and his head and his back and much of his face was covered with weedy, long black hair. His proportions were a shock to my mother, for his limbs were tiny, and he seemed to be all head and belly. His fingers and toes were almost without nails. His cry was like the mewing of a sick kitten. But he was alive, and something had to be done about him quickly. Dr. McCausland had never met with a baby so dismayingly premature as this, but he had read of such things, and while my mother held Paul as near the fire as was safe, he and the badly shaken father set to work to build a nest that would be as much as possible like what the infant was used to. It underwent several changes, but in the end it was an affair of jeweler's cotton and hot water bottles, assisted at the beginning by a few hot bricks, with a tent over it into which the steam from a kettle was directed. The kettle had to be watched carefully so that it might neither boil dry nor yet boil the baby. The doctor did not know what to do about feeding the child, but he and my mother worked out a combination of a glass fountain pen filler and a scrap of soft cotton wool through which they pumped diluted, sweetened milk into Paul, and Paul feebly pumped it right back out again. It was not for 2 days that he kept any perceptible portion of the food, but his vomiting gained a very little in strength. It was then that my mother decided that he was a fighter, and determined to fight with him. Immediately after the birth, the doctor and my mother were busy with the baby. Mrs. Dempster was left to the care of her husband, and he did the best he knew how for her, which was to kneel and pray out loud by her bedside. Poor Amasa Dempster was the most serious of men, and his background and training had not provided him with tact. He besought God, if he must take the soul of Mary Dempster to him, to do so with gentleness and mercy. He reminded God that little Paul had been baptized, and that therefore the soul of the infant was secure and would be best able to journey to heaven in the company of its mother. He labored these themes with as much eloquence as he could summon, until Dr. McCausland was compelled to read the Riot Act to him, in such terms as a tight-lipped Presbyterian uses when reading the Riot Act to an emotional Baptist. This term, reading the Riot Act, was my mother's. She had thoroughly approved of the doctor's performance, for she had the real Scots satisfaction in hearing somebody justifiably scolded and set to rights. "Carrying on like that, right over the girl's bed, while she was fighting for her life," she said to my father, and I could imagine the sharp shake of the head that accompanied her speech. I wonder now if Mrs. Dempster was really fighting for her life. Subsequent circumstances proved that she was stronger than anybody knew. But it was an accepted belief at that time that no woman bore a child without walking very close to the brink of death. And for anything I know to the contrary, it may have been true at that stage of medical science. But certainly it must have seemed to poor Dempster that his wife was dying. He had hung about all through the birth. He had seen his hideous, misshapen child. He had been pushed about and bustled by the doctor and the good neighbor. He was a parson, of course, but at root he was a frightened farmer lad, and if he lost his head, I cannot now blame him. He was one of those people who seem fated to be hurt and thrown aside in life, but doubtless, as he knelt by Mary's bed, he thought himself as important an actor in the drama as any of the others. This is one of the cruelties of the theater of life. We all think of ourselves as stars, and rarely recognize it when we are indeed mere supporting characters, or even supernumeraries. What the following months cost in disorganization of our household, you can imagine. My father never complained of it, for he was devoted to my mother, considered her to be a wonderful woman, and would not have done anything to prevent her from manifesting her wonderfulness. We ate many a scratch meal so that little Paul might not miss his chance with the fountain pen filler. And when the great day came at last, when the infant retained a perceptible part of what it was given, I think my father was even more pleased than my mother. The weeks passed, and Paul's wrinkled skin became less transparent and angry. His wide-set eyes opened and roamed about, unseeing but certainly not blind, and he kicked his feet just a little, like a real baby. Would he ever be strong? Dr. McCausland could not say. He was the epitome of Scott's caution. But my mother's lion-like spirit was already determined that Paul should have his chance. It was during these weeks that I endured agony of mind that seems to me, looking back over more than 60 years, to have been extraordinary. I have had hard times since then, and have endured them with all the capability for suffering of a grown man. So I do not want to make foolish and sentimental claims for the suffering of a child. But even now I hesitate to recall some of the nights when I feared to go to sleep and prayed till I sweated that God would forgive me for my mountainous crime. I was perfectly sure, you see, that the birth of Paul Dempster, so small, so feeble and troublesome, was my fault. If I had not been so clever, so sly, so spiteful in hopping in front of the Dempsters just as Percy Boyd Staunton threw that snowball at me from behind, Mrs. Dempster would not have been struck. Did I never think that Percy was guilty? Indeed I did. But a psychological difficulty arose here. When next I met him, after that bad afternoon, we approached each other warily, as boys do after a quarrel, and he seemed disposed to talk. I did not at once speak of the birth of Paul, but I crept up on the subject and was astonished to hear him say, "Yes, my pa says McCausland has his hands full with that one." "The baby came too soon," said I, testing him. "Did it?" said he, looking me straight in the eyes. "And you know why?" I said. "No, I don't." "Yes, you do. You threw that snowball." "I threw a snowball at you," he replied, "and I guess it gave you a good smack." I could tell by the frank boldness of his tone that he was lying. "Do you mean to say that's what you think?" I said. "You bet it's what I think," said he, "and it's what you'd better think, too, if you know what's good for you." We looked into each other's eyes, and I knew that he was afraid, and I knew also that he would fight, lie, do anything rather than admit what I knew, and I didn't know what in the world I could do about it. So I was alone with my guilt, and it tortured me. I was a Presbyterian child, and I knew a good deal about damnation. We had a Dante's Inferno among my father's books, with the illustrations by Doré. Such books were common in rural districts at that time. And probably none of us was really aware that Dante was an R.C. It had once been a shivery pleasure to look at those pictures. Now I knew that they showed the reality of my situation, and what lay beyond this life for such a boy as I. I was of the damned. Such a phrase seemed to mean nothing to people nowadays, but to me it was utterly real. I pined and wasted to some extent, and my mother was not so taken up with the Dempsters that she failed to dose me regularly with cod liver oil. But though I did not really suffer much physically, I suffered greatly in my mind, for a reason connected with my time of life. I was just upon 11, and I matured early, so that some of the earliest changes of puberty were beginning in me. How healthy-minded children seem to be nowadays! Or is it just the cant of our time to believe so? I cannot tell. But certainly in my childhood, the common attitude towards matters of sex was enough to make a hell of adolescence for any boy who was, like myself, deeply serious and mistrustful of whatever seemed pleasurable in life. So here I was, subject not only to the smutty, whispering speculations of the other boys I knew, and tormented by the suspicion that my parents were somehow involved in this hog-wallow of sex that had begun to bulk so large in my thoughts, but I was directly responsible for a grossly sexual act, the birth of a child. And what a child! Hideous, stricken, a caricature of a living creature. In the hot craziness of my thinking, I began to believe that I was more responsible for the birth of Paul Dempster than were his parents, and that if this were ever discovered, some dreadful fate would overtake me. Part of the dreadful fate would undoubtedly be rejection by my mother. I could not bear the thought, but neither could I let it alone. My troubles became no less when, at least 4 months after Paul's birth, I heard this coming up the stovepipe. Cooler now, for spring was well advanced. "I think little Paul is going to pull through. He'll be slow, the doctor says, but he'll be all right."
"You must be pleased. It's mostly your doing."
"Oh, no, I only did what I could. But the doctor says he hopes somebody will keep an eye on Paul. His mother certainly can't."
"She isn't coming around."
"Doesn't appear so. It was a terrible shock for the poor little thing.
And Amasa Dempster just won't believe that there's a time to talk about God and a time to trust God and keep your mouth shut. Luckily, she doesn't seem to understand a lot of what he says."
"Do you mean she's gone simple?"
"She's as quiet and friendly and sweet-natured as she ever was, poor little soul, but she just isn't all there. That snowball certainly did a terrible thing to her.
Who do you suppose threw it?"
"Dempster couldn't see. I don't suppose anybody will ever know."
"I've wondered more than once if Dunstable knows more about that than he's letting on."
"Oh, no. He knows how serious it is. If he knew anything, he'd have spoken up by now."
"Whoever it was, the devil guided his hand."
"Yes, and the devil shifted his mark. Mrs. Dempster had gone simple. I crept to bed, wondering if I would live through the night, and at the same time, desperately afraid to die."
5.
Ah, if dying were all there was to it! Hell and torment at once, but at least you know where you stand. It is living with these guilty secrets that exacts the price. Yet the more time that passed, the less I was able to accuse Percy Boyd Staunton of having thrown the snowball that sent Mrs. Dempster simple. His brazen-faced refusal to accept responsibility seemed to deepen my own guilt, which had now become the guilt of concealment as well as action. However, as time passed, Mrs. Dempster's simplicity did not seem to be as terrible as I had at first feared. My mother, with her unfailing good sense, hit the nail on the head when she said that Mrs. Dempster was really no different from what she had been before, except that she was more so. When Amasa Dempster had brought his little bride to our village the spring before the Christmas of Paul's untimely birth, the opinion had been strong among the women that nothing would ever make a preacher's wife out of that one. I have already said that while our village contained much of what humanity has to show, it did not contain everything, and one of the things it conspicuously lacked was an aesthetic sense. We were all too much the descendants of hard-bitten pioneers to wish for or encourage any such thing, and we gave hard names to qualities that, in a more sophisticated society, might have had value. Mrs. Dempster was not pretty. We understood prettiness, and guardedly admitted it as a pleasant, if needless, thing in a woman. But she had a gentleness of expression and a delicacy of color that was uncommon. My mother, who had strong features and stood for no nonsense from her hair, said that Mrs. Dempster had a face like a pan of milk. Mrs. Dempster was small and slight, and even the clothes approved for a preacher's wife did not conceal the fact that she had a girlish figure and a light step. When she was pregnant, there was a bloom about her that seemed out of keeping with the seriousness of her state. It was not at all the proper thing for a pregnant woman to smile so much, and the least she could have done was to take a stronger line with those waving tendrils of hair that seemed so often to be escaping from a properly severe arrangement. She was a nice little thing, but was that soft voice ever going to dominate a difficult meeting of the Ladies' Aid? And why did she laugh so much, when nobody else could see anything to laugh at? Amasa Dempster, who had always seemed a level-headed man for a preacher, was plain silly about his wife. His eyes were always on her, and he could be seen drawing pails of water from their outside well for the washing. When this was fully understood to be woman's work, right up to the last month or so of a pregnancy, the way he looked at her would make you wonder if the man was soft in the head. You would think they were still courting instead of being expected to get down to the Lord's work and earn his $550 per annum. This was what the Baptists paid their preacher, as well as allowing him a house, not quite enough fuel, and a 10% discount on everything bought in a Baptist-owned store, and a few other stores that honored the cloth, as the saying went. Of course, he was expected to give back an exact tenth of it to the church, to set an example. The hope was widely expressed that Mr. Dempster was not going to make a fool of his wife. In our village, hard talk was not always accompanied by hard action. My mother, who could certainly never have been accused of softness with her family or the world, went out of her way to help Mrs. Dempster. I will not say to befriend her, because friendship between such unequal characters could never have been. But she tried to show her the ropes, and whatever these mysterious feminine ropes were, they certainly included many good things that my mother cooked and just happened to leave when she dropped in on the young bride, and not merely the loan, but the practical demonstration of such devices as carpet stretchers, racks for drying lace curtains, and the art of shining windows with newspaper. Why had Mrs. Dempster's mother never prepared her for these aspects of marriage? It came out she had been brought up by an aunt who had money and kept a hired girl. And how were you to forge a preacher's wife from such weak metal as that? When my father teased my mother about the amount of food she took the Dempsters, she became huffy and asked if she was to allow them to starve under her nose while that girl was learning the ropes. But the girl was slow, and my mother's answer to that was that in her condition she couldn't be expected to be quick. Now it did not seem that she would ever learn the craft of housekeeping. Her recovery from Paul's birth was tardy, and while she grew strong again, her husband looked after the domestic affairs, helped by neighbor women and a Baptist widow for whose occasional services he was able to eke out a very little money. As spring came, Mrs. Dempster was perfectly able-bodied, but showed no signs of getting down to work. She did a little cleaning and some inept cooking, and laughed like a girl at her failures. She hovered over the baby, and as he changed from a raw monster to a small but recognizably Christian-looking infant, she was as delighted as a little girl with a doll. She now breastfed him. My mother and all the neighbors had to admit that she did it well. But she lacked the solemnity they expected of a nursing mother. She enjoyed the process, and sometimes when they went into the house, there she was, with everything showing, even though her husband was present, just as if she hadn't the sense to pull up her clothes. I happened upon her once or twice in this condition, and gaped with the greedy eyes of an adolescent boy, but she did not seem to notice. And thus the opinion grew that Mrs. Dempster was simple. There was only one thing to be done, and that was to help the Dempsters as much as possible, without approving or encouraging any tendencies that might run contrary to the right way of doing things.
My mother ordered me over to the Dempsters to chop and pile wood, sweep away snow, cut the grass, weed the vegetable patch, and generally make myself handy 2 or 3 times a week, and on Saturdays if necessary. I was also to keep an eye on the baby, for my mother could not rid herself of a dread that Mrs. Dempster would allow it to choke or fall out of its basket or otherwise come to grief. There was no chance of such a thing happening, as I soon found, but obeying my instructions brought me much into the company of Mrs. Dempster, who laughed at my concern for the baby. She did not seem to think that it could come to any harm in her keeping, and I know now that she was right, and that my watchfulness must have been intrusive and clumsy. Caring for a baby is one thing, and the many obligations of a parson's wife are another, and for this work Mrs. Dempster showed no aptitude at all. By the time a year had passed since Paul's birth, her husband had become poor Reverend Dempster to everybody, a man burdened with a simple-minded wife and a delicate child, and it was a general source of amazement that he could make ends meet. Certainly a man with $550 a year needed a thrifty wife, and Mrs. Dempster gave away everything. There was a showdown once when she gave an ornamental vase to a woman who had taken her a few bakings of bread. The vase was part of the furnishings of the parsonage, not the personal property of the Dempsters, and the ladies of the church were up in arms at this act of feckless generosity, and demanded of Amasa Dempster that he send his wife to the neighbor's house to ask for the vase back, and if this meant eating crow, she would have to eat crow. But he would not humiliate his wife, and went on the distasteful errand himself, which everybody agreed was weakness in him and would lead to worse things. One of my jobs, under instruction from my mother, was to watch for chalk marks on the Dempster's veranda posts and rub them out when I saw them. These chalk marks were put there by tramps as signals to one another that the house was good for a generous handout, and perhaps even money. After a year or so, most of the women in our village grew tired of pitying the Baptist parson and his wife, and began to think that he was as simple as she. Like many ostracized people, they became more marked in their oddity. But my mother never wavered. Her compassion was not of the short-term variety. Consequently, as they became, in a sense, charges of my family, my jobs for the Dempsters grew. My brother Willie did very little about them. He was 2 years older than I, and his schoolwork was more demanding. Further, after school hours, he now went to the Banner printing plant to make himself useful and pick up the trade. But my mother was as watchful as ever, and my father, in whose eyes she could do nothing wrong, approved completely of all that was done. 6. Being unofficial watchdog to the Dempster family was often a nuisance to me and did nothing for my popularity. But at this time I was growing rapidly and was strong for my age, so not many of the people with whom I went to school liked to say too much to my face. But I knew that they said enough behind my back. Percy Boyd Staunton was one of these. He had a special place in our school world. There are people who, even as boys, assume superior airs and are taken as grandees by those around them. He was as big as I, and rather fleshy. Without being a fat boy, he was plump. His clothes were better than ours, and he had an interesting pocket knife, with a chain on it to fasten to his knickerbockers, and an ink bottle you could knock over without spilling a drop. On Sundays, he wore a suit with a fashionable half-belt at the back. He had once been to Toronto to the exhibition, and altogether breathed a larger air than the rest of us. He and I were rivals, for though I had none of his graces of person or wealth, I had a sharp tongue. I was raw-boned and wore clothes that had often made an earlier appearance on Willie, but I had a turn for sarcastic remarks, which were known to our group as good ones. If I was pushed too far, I might get off a good one. And as our community had a long memory, such dour witticisms would be remembered and quoted for years. I had a good one already for Percy, if ever he gave me any trouble. I had heard his mother tell my mother that when he was a dear little fellow, just learning to talk, his best version of his name, Percy Boyd, was Pidgey Boy Boy, and she still called him that in moments of unbuttoned affection. I knew that I had but once to call him Pidgey Boy Boy in the schoolyard, and his goose would be cooked. Probably suicide would be his only way out.
This knowledge gave me a sense of power in reserve. I needed it. Some of the oddity and loneliness of the Dempsters was beginning to rub off on me. Having double chores to do kept me out of many a game I would have liked to join, dodging back and forth between their house and ours with this, that, and the other thing. I was sure to meet some of my friends. Mrs. Dempster often stood in the door when I was running home, waving and thanking me in a voice that seemed to me eerie and likely to bring mockery down on my head, not hers, if anybody overheard her, as they often did. I knew that some of them had nicknamed me Nursie. They did not call me that to my face, however. My position here was worst of all. I wanted to be on good terms with the girls I knew. I suppose I wanted them to admire me and think me wonderful in some unspecified way. Enough of them were silly about Percy and sent him mash valentines on February 14, without any names on them but with handwriting that betrayed the sender. No girl ever sent me a valentine except Elsie Webb, known to us all as Spider Webb because of her gawky, straddling walk. I did not want Spider Webb. I wanted Leola Cruikshank, who had corkscrew curls and a great way of never meeting your eyes. But my feeling about Leola was put askew by my feeling about Mrs. Dempster. Leola I wanted as a trophy of success, but Mrs. Dempster was beginning to fill my whole life, and the stranger her conduct became, and the more the village pitied and dismissed her, the worse my obsession grew. I thought I was in love with Leola, by which I meant that if I could have found her in a quiet corner, and if I had been certain that no one would ever find out, and if I could have summoned up the courage at the right moment, I would have kissed her. But looking back on it now, I know I was in love with Mrs. Dempster. Not as some boys are in love with grown-up women, adoring them from afar and enjoying a fantasy life in which the older woman figures in an idealized form, but in a painful and immediate fashion. I saw her every day. I did menial tasks in her house, and I was charged to watch her and keep her from doing foolish things. Furthermore, I felt myself tied to her by the certainty that I was responsible for her straying wits, the disorder of her marriage, and the frail body of the child who was her great delight in life. I had made her what she was, and in such circumstances I must hate her or love her. In a mode that was far too demanding for my age or experience, I loved her. Loving her, I had to defend her, and when people said she was crazy, I had to force myself to tell them that they were crazy themselves, and I would knock their blocks off if they said it again. Fortunately, one of the first people with whom I had such an encounter was Milo Papple, and he was not hard to deal with. Milo was our school buffoon, the son of Myron Papple, the village barber. Barbers in more sophisticated communities are sometimes men with rich heads of hair, or men who have given a special elegance to a bald head. But Myron Papple had no such outward grace. He was a short, fat, pear-shaped man, with the complexion and hair of a pig of the Chester White breed. He had but one distinction. He put 5 sticks of gum into his mouth every morning and chewed the wad until he closed his shop in the evening, breathing peppermint on each customer as he shaved, clipped, and talked. Milo was his father in miniature, and admitted by us all to be a card. His repertoire of jokes was small but of timeless durability. He could belch at will, and did. He could also break wind at will, with a prolonged, whining note of complaint, and when he did so in class, and then looked around with an angry face, whispering, "Who done that?" Our mirth was Chaucerian, and the teacher was reduced to making a refined face, as if she were too good for a world in which such things were possible. Even the girls, even Leola Cruikshank, thought Milo was a card. One day I was asked if I would play ball after school. I said I had to do some work. "Sure," said Milo. "Donnie's got to get right over to the bug house and cut the grass." "The bug house?" asked a few who were slow of wit. "Yep. The Dempsters. That's the bug house now." It was now or never for me. "Milo," I said, "if you ever say that again, I'll get a great big cork and stick it up you, and then nobody'll ever laugh at you again." As I said this, I walked menacingly towards him, and as soon as Milo backed away, I knew I was the victor, for the moment. The joke about Milo and the cork was frugally husbanded by our collectors of funny sayings, and he was not allowed to forget it. If you stuck a cork in Milo, nobody would ever laugh at him again, these unashamed gleaners of the fields of repartee would say and shout with laughter. Nobody said bughouse to me for a long time, but sometimes I could see that they wanted to say it, and I knew they said it behind my back. This increased my sense of isolation, of being forced out of the world I belonged to into the strange and unchancy world of the Dempsters. 7. The passing of time brought other isolations. At 13, I should have been learning the printing business. My father was neat-handed and swift, and Willie was following in his steps. But I was all thumbs in the shop, slow to learn the layout of the frames in which the fonts of type were distributed. Clumsy at locking up a form, messy with ink, a great spoiler of paper, and really not much good at anything but cutting reglet or reading proof, which my father never trusted to anyone but himself in any case. I never mastered the printer's trick of reading things upside down and backward, and I never properly learned how to fold a sheet. Altogether, I was a nuisance in the shop, and as this humiliated me, and my father was a kindly man, he sought some other honorable work to keep me from under his feet. It had been suggested that our village library should be open a few afternoons a week so that the more responsible school children might use it, and somebody was needed to serve as under-librarian, the real librarian being busy as a teacher during the daytime and not relishing the loss of so much of her free time. I was appointed to this job at a salary of nothing at all, the honor being deemed sufficient reward. This suited me admirably. 3 afternoons a week I opened our one-room library in the upstairs of the town hall and lorded it over any school children who appeared. Once I had the dizzy pleasure of finding something in the encyclopedia for Leola Cruikshank, who had to write an essay about the equator and didn't know whether it went over the top or round the middle. More afternoons than not, nobody appeared, or else those who came went away as soon as they found what they wanted, and I had the library to myself. It was not much of a collection, perhaps 1,500 books in all, of which roughly a tenth part were for children. The annual budget was $25, and much of that went on subscriptions to magazines that the magistrate, who was chairman of the board, wanted to read. Acquisitions, therefore, were usually gifts from the estates of people who had died, and our local auctioneer gave us any books that he could not sell. We kept what we wanted and sent the rest to the Grenfell Mission on the principle that savages would read anything. The consequence was that we had some odd things, of which the oddest were kept in a locked closet off the main room. There was a medical book with a frightful engraving of a fallen womb, and another of a varicose seal, and a portrait of a man with lavish hair and whiskers but no nose, which made me a lifelong enemy of syphilis. My special treasures were The Secrets of Stage Conjuring by Robert Houdin and Modern Magic and Later Magic by Professor Hoffman. They had been banished as uninteresting. Uninteresting. And as soon as I saw them, I knew that fate meant them for me. By studying them, I should become a conjurer, astonish everybody, win the breathless admiration of Leola Cruikshank, and become a great power. I immediately hid them in a place where they could not fall into the hands of unworthy persons, including our librarian, and devoted myself to the study of magic. I still look back upon those hours when I acquainted myself with the means by which a French conjurer had astonished the subjects of Louis Napoleon as an era of Arcadian pleasure. It did not matter that everything about the book was hopelessly old-fashioned. Great as the gap between me and Robert Houdin was, I could accept his world as the real world, so far as the wonderful art of deception was concerned. When he insisted on the necessity of things that were unknown to Deptford, I assumed that it was because Deptford was a village, and Paris was a great and sophisticated capital, where everybody who was anybody was mad for conjuring and wanted nothing more than to be delightfully bamboozled by an elegant, slightly sinister, but wholly charming master of the art. It did not surprise me in the least that Robert Houdin's emperor had sent him on a special diplomatic mission to Algiers to destroy the power of the marabouts by showing that his magic was greater than theirs. When I read of his feat on the Shah of Turkey's yacht, when he hammered the Shah's jeweled watch to ruins in a mortar, then threw the rubbish overboard, cast a line into the sea, pulled up a fish,
asked the Shah's chef to clean it, and stood by while the chef discovered the watch, quite unharmed, enclosed in a silk bag in the entrails of the fish. I felt that this was life as it ought to be lived. Conjurers were obviously fellows of the first importance and kept distinguished company. I would be one of them. The Scottish practicality that I had imitated from my parents was not really ingrained with me. I cared too little for difficulties. I admitted to myself that Deptford was unlikely to yield a conjurer's table, a gilded guéridon with a cunning servante on the back of it for storing things one did not wish to have seen, and a gibecière into which coins and watches could noiselessly be dropped. I had no tailcoat, and if I had, I doubt if my mother would have sewn a proper conjurer's profonde in the tails for disappearing things. When Professor Hoffman instructed me to fold back my cuffs, I knew that I had no cuffs, but did not care. I would devote myself to illusions that did not require such things. These illusions, I discovered, called for special apparatus, always described by the professor as simple, which the conjurer was advised to make himself. For me, a boy who always tied his shoelaces backward and whose Sunday tie looked like a hangman's noose, such apparatus presented a problem that I had to admit, after a few tries, was insuperable. Nor could I do anything about the tricks that required a few substances easily obtainable from any chemist, because Ruckel's drugstore had never heard of any of them. But I was not defeated. I would excel in the realm which Robert Houdin said was the truest, most classical form of conjuring. I would be a master of sleight of hand, a matchless prestidigitateur. It was like me to begin with eggs, or, to be precise, one egg. It never occurred to me that a clay egg, of the kind used to deceive hens, would do just as well. I hooked an egg from my mother's kitchen, and when the library was empty, began to practice producing it from my mouth, elbow, and back of the knee, also putting it into my right ear, and after a little hen-like clucking, removing it from my left. I seemed to be getting on splendidly, and when the magistrate made a sudden appearance to get the latest scribners, I had a mad moment when I thought of amazing him by taking an egg out of his beard. Of course, I did not dare to go so far, but the delightful thought that I could if I wanted to put me into such a fit of giggles that he looked at me speculatively. When he was gone, I handled the egg with greater boldness until, disappearing it into my hip pocket, I put my thumb through it. Ha ha. Every boy has experiences of this kind, and they are usually thought to be funny and childlike. But that egg led to a dreadful row with my mother. She had missed the egg. It never occurred to me that anybody counted eggs, and accused me of taking it. I lied. Then she caught me trying to wash out my pocket, because in a house with no running water, washing cannot be a really private business. She exposed my lie and demanded to know what I wanted with an egg. Now how can a boy of 13 tell a Scotswoman widely admired for her practicality that he intends to become the world's foremost prestidigitateur? I took refuge in mute insolence. She stormed. She demanded to know if I thought she was made of eggs. Visited unhappily by a good one, I said that that was something she would have to decide for herself. My mother had little sense of humor. She told me that if I thought I had grown too old to be beaten, she would show me I was mistaken, and from the kitchen cupboard she produced the pony whip. It was not for ponies. In my boyhood, such pretty little whips were sold at country fairs, where children bought them and flourished them and occasionally beat trees with them. But a few years earlier, my mother had impounded such a whip that Willie had brought home, and it had been used for beatings ever since. It had been at least 2 years since I had had a beating, but now my mother flourished the whip, and when I laughed, she struck me over the left shoulder with it. "Don't you dare touch me!" I shouted, and that put her into such a fury as I had never known. It must have been a strange scene, for she pursued me around the kitchen, slashing me with the whip until she broke me down, and I cried. She cried, too, hysterically, and beat me harder, storming about my impudence, my want of respect for her, of my increasing oddity and intellectual arrogance. Not that she used these words, but I do not intend to put down what she actually said. Until at last her fury was spent, and she ran upstairs in tears and banged the door of her bedroom. I crept off to the woodshed, a criminal,
and wondered what I should do. Become a tramp, perhaps, like the shabby, sinister fellows who came so often to our back door for a handout. Hang myself? I have been very miserable since. Miserable not for an hour, but for months on end. But I can still feel that hour's misery in its perfect desolation, if I am fool enough to call it up in my mind. My father and Willie came home, and there was no supper. Naturally, he sided with her, and Willie was very officious and knowing about how intolerable I had become of late, and how thrashing was too good for me. Finally, it was settled that my mother would come downstairs if I would beg pardon. This I had to do on my knees, repeating a formula improvised by my father, which included a pledge that I would always love my mother, to whom I owed the great gift of life, and that I begged her, and secondarily God, to forgive me, knowing full well that I was unworthy of such clemency. I rose from my knees, cleansed and purged, and ate very little supper, as became a criminal. When it came time for me to go to bed, my mother beckoned me to her, and kissed me, and whispered, "I know I'll never have another anxious moment with my own dear laddie." I pondered these words before I went to sleep. How could I reconcile this motherliness with the screeching fury who had pursued me around the kitchen with a whip, flogging me until she was gorged with— What? Vengeance? What was it? Once, when I was in my 30s, and reading Freud for the first time, I thought I knew. I am not so sure I know now. But what I knew then was that nobody, not even my mother, was to be trusted in a strange world that showed very little of itself on the surface. 8. Instead of sickening me of magic, this incident increased my appetite for it.